Welcome to Dark Mugwort's Twin Peaks Podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode. This is Ethan.
This is Nick.
And that little gap, that little bit of silence you heard was the sound of our non-existent guest this week. We're riding solo. There was a little misfortune with our guests, but hopefully they'll be on soon. We really want them on. But I think we'll be good because we're here to talk about, I think, one of the most popular hours so far, I'd say. Would you agree?
Oh, I would say so, especially if the reaction from my viewing party is any indication.
Oof. This, of course, being hour 11 of Twin Peaks Return, entitled There's Fire Where You Are Going, which, of course, I think, and like most people, I had a feeling that was something the log lady would say. But, I mean, just to dive into this episode, I kind of presented a thesis, or not a thesis, but maybe more a theory. I can't really present a theory until the show is over. But a theory that the show sort of has episodes that can be grouped into each other, ones that are a little more expository, ones that are a little more challenging, and ones that are, for better or worse, I don't know if this term really applies, but crowd pleasers. And I kind of feel like this episode was, in terms of, I guess, presenting the intermingling of surrealism and humor.
No doubt. I found myself occupying two headspaces primarily through this episode. One was something I never do watching anything, which is genuinely yelping in fear and putting my hand over my mouth and my eyes wide open, thinking that I'm about to see something truly catastrophic. And the other is laughing so hard that I kind of wondered for a second if I would have to leave the room, particularly because the sequence in particular that made me laugh to the point of insanity was followed immediately by a quiet plot-moving sequence. And I was, as with last week, pretty amazed at how it is oscillating between these states. And not just the fact that it's doing it, but that you can actually draw clear lines between these various sequences, and not just narratively, but thematically. And it is odd because it is also breeding a certain frustration of wondering how much we're seeing sort of a compromised version of this project, because I think about this hour in relation to the last hour in relation to the hour before that, et cetera, et cetera. And you get the sense that what Lynch and Frost are doing with tone is such a up and down roller coaster ride that is really meant to be experienced as more of a single entity than anything else. And if nothing else, it will have me most likely doing a extended run through the series once it's available on Blu-ray or whatever when it comes out at that time.
Or 4K Blu-ray?
Ultra HD, yes, absolutely. I don't have a 4K TV or a 4K Blu-ray player, but you maybe ain't, just you for this.
What was the format that on the PSP?
UMD? That was a... It was a UMD, that's right.
Okay, I'm going to watch on that.
Okay. I wonder do you think any David Lynch films are on UMD?
Dune, maybe.
Okay, was that a Sony film?
Yes, it was Universal.
It was Universal. I don't think he's ever made a film with Sony.
Maybe else.
But there were non-Sony movies on UMD. I'm going to put my mic on mute while you talk, and I'll just Google around to see if I can come up with this.
You do that.
Okay.
But yeah, I think what's almost curious about this episode is I almost feel like it can be kind of described as an action episode in an odd way, whatever the David Lynch version of an action movie is. But I mean, it begins essentially with a set piece. It begins with this kind of propulsion, which I think is almost unlike a lot of the glacial, and I mean glacial in a good way, pacing of the show so far, where we have the Lynch favorite of a woman in trouble, this being Amanda Seyfried's Becky. And the music is, the Badalamenti score is at its most intense. And we're getting essentially, we get a car stunt, a fired gun, and a seemingly supernatural, like, roving camera through the hallways of an apartment building.
Some sort of ghostly perspective, perhaps? Hmm. Yes. I don't know what else you would call it, exactly. If nothing else, it is a classic Lynch thing, sort of the visual externalization of extreme emotional distress, perhaps. The way that it travels down this hallway, seemingly through an area that we haven't seen, or at least an area that we haven't seen from this particular angle, and then does this kind of sudden cut to Caleb Landry-Jones and Ethan.
Alicia Witt returning as Gersten Hayward, who I believe we last ever saw in the character, not the actress. We last saw in episode 1 of season 2 playing the piano in the Hayward home over the end credits of the episode.
That sounds about right. Yes. Donna's sister, Doc's daughter. Mm-hmm. She is a cougar at this point. Yeah.
What I think is interesting about Seyfried as Becky is I feel like she's been different in every episode. I mean, if you had to make a screen cap that encapsulated her in all three episodes she's appeared so far, obviously in her first episode it'd be her in the car, high on coke. Second would be probably her cowering on her couch. And probably the third would be either her behind the wheel or firing a gun at the door. I mean, you had a tweet before and after logging in, I believe, which basically made the same point more succinctly through images.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I now have just been conditioned to have the kind of brain that immediately thinks that as soon as that otherwise wonderful scene progresses and then keeps it stored in my brain long enough so that when I get home from where I'm watching it, I can just screen cap it in and make that one. I actually have another one, which I am saving for tomorrow. I hope everybody's excited. By the time this airs, you'll be able to find it if you wish.
Also, I mean, we have what I thought. I mean, people have been making a lot of comparisons to other filmmakers throughout the season. You've brought up Pedro Costa, Manuel de Oliveira, so on and so forth. But this week we get a Richard Kelly portal.
Oh, hell yeah. It's funny because I actually, before watching this episode, I saw for the first time Catherine Bigelow's Strange Days. And after I saw it, I had tweeted somewhat pithily, somewhat at his expense, even though I do love the guy. I tweeted, so that's where Richard Kelly comes from. Because if you've seen Strange Days and you've seen the films of Richard Kelly, I think the overlaps between them will become apparent in about a second and a half. And to follow that with this was a pleasure, you know? We don't have enough Kelly. We don't have any Kelly in this decade. So to get those little steps towards that is nice.
I mean,
what do you think David Lynch would make of Richard Kelly, because you brought up Southland Tales last week with the Rebecca Del Rio performance in both.
I feel like he'd be like, not my cup of tea.
Mm. Or would he lie about seeing it?
Maybe.
The way he's apparently lied about seeing Selena Julia go boating.
Anyway, though, it's curious. I want to mention that same sequence. Do you remember the first teaser back, I want to say, in December of 2015. In fact, I think this teaser came out the day the Force Awakens did, and it was just basically almost like an announcement of production teaser with Michael mm-hmm. Horse, but it ended, it had the stinger of the what seemed almost like Lynch holding a camera and shaking it himself, and that turned out to be actual footage, which we see here.
Yeah, no, I thought that was lovely. And a year after that, the weekend that Star Wars Rogue One premiered, we got the teaser of David Lynch eating the donut, which we see fulfilled here.
Holy shit, it's all
together. In fact, if you, somebody on my Twitter timeline, I'll admit I have Twitter open as I'm recording this, tweeted a screen cap of Laura Dern saying, you know how good a cigarette would taste with this coffee, and the expression on David Lynch's face is the expression that so many people use as their Twitter icons immediately following that several months ago. So this, yeah, this is the big reveal episode, Ethan.
Also, I think there's a notable set piece, really an impressive sustained mood, or maybe not even a sustained mood, more an escalating mood, I can think of. Okay, sorry. Hell yeah. I knew it.
Oh.
Sorry, Nick just interrupted a point I was about to make. He sent me that there is, in fact, a UMD of Dune available on UK eBay. So,
on Italian eBay, on Italian Amazon, oh. I found a French edition of it. UMD Video Por PSP, Dune, un film de David Lynch. Hmm. So yes, there is one at least David Lynch film on the UMD format. Anyway, continue.
There's the whole diner sequence kind of in and out, so to speak, which begins as kind of a conventional shot, reverse shot, actor-driven. I mean, the first thing I noticed is how Dana Ashbrook has kind of maintained this certain hunch. I don't know if it's as much just an actorly trait as it is the character of Bobby, but it's kind of a touching note of the passage of time in a way. But I'd say the sequence where it becomes noticeably impressive is when Balthazar Getty, you see, enters through, you see him entering through the window. And there's a great shot I screen capped. I can't believe no one has shared this screen cap, basically, of Shelley embracing Becky, then her face instantly lighting up. And Jordan, if you're listening, please maybe make that the episode cover art. But then she runs out, runs back in, then a bullet goes through the double R, then Bobby exits, you know, badass Steven Seagal lawman style, and finds it was more just the result of irresponsible gun owners in America, small town America. But then a traffic jam. And then the sequence that made Nick do what he did.
What? Oh, yes. The laugh itself. Yeah, so it's funny because when that part of the sequence starts wherein Bobby opens the car door and, or rather has the window roll down and the woman starts yelling at him, I thought it was amusing, but I wasn't completely blown away by it necessarily because it just felt like a familiar Lynchian thing. In particular, it reminded me of the woman in The Straight Story who hits the deer and she gets out of the car and she starts screaming about how deer keep jumping in front of her car. It felt like very similar expressions of rage, and I was amused by it. And then suddenly a child of some sort is vomiting, not only vomiting green slime, but being raised in such a way where it looks as if they are being resurrected from the dead, and turns towards Bobby and is just kind of staring at him, vomiting up this green slime. And all the while, this woman is letting out this scream that I think kind of resembles Sam Kinison. Just this. I won't actually scream it for the sake of our listeners, but I'll use a room level voice and and I think why I found it so funny is that it seems to have been played on a loop, that it was the same maybe two or three screams recorded and then just played continuously as Bobby is just sort of staring. And it was that followed by kind of the punctuation on that sequence is cutting to the sheriff's office and this very quiet dialogue between Robert Forster and Hawk. And I just, I was sitting there. There were, you know, 8, 9 other people in the room with me. And I'm just trying to control myself.
You were the only one laughing?
Well, people laughed at that scene. But then the next scene went on and people seemed to have moved on. But I was just, I had said to somebody that the reaction I had was basically akin to if you're at a funeral and the casket is being lowered into the ground and you suddenly remember your favorite joke, like how would you react in that moment? It, like, I mean, like really just your favorite, most gut-bustingly funny joke. That is what, that is what was going on there. That is how I was reacting. And yeah, it's not only that, but the fact that you can, again, you can draw this direct narrative line between this, the sequence that had terrified me so much, which is Becky sort of fleeing and Shelley on top of the car, this first person POV shot of Machen Amick just clearly in terror on top of this car. And I'm honestly wondering, oh my God, is this episode going to start with one of the oldest characters being killed off in a very unceremonious fashion? We get nothing close to that, but in the moment I genuinely believed that this was going to happen. That the meeting of the family, by the way, also the reveal that Bobby is in fact the girl's father. It's not really a surprise, but
I mean, he still gets cucked in that sequence.
Does he get cucked?
Well, I mean, he definitely has his manhood.
Yes. Oh, no, certainly. True. We've done a lot of discussion of cucking on this, haven't we?
This show is about being an American in 2017. Well, or 2016, or 2015, I guess, even.
I think 2015, 2016, 2017 is fairly porous in this case, which... Anyway, yeah, no. Well, also just these shifts in emotion on an individual character's part and how an entire sequence pivots around it, not just on a tonal scale, but even on a visual level, how Balthazar Getty approaching the window is this whole new perspective we're seeing. From outside, inside is a new perspective we're seeing. Her going out onto the street in this very weird view, because we've actually never, as far as I can recall, never seen the Double R Diner kind of from this perspective, or we've never seen outside the Double R Diner in the ways that we're seeing it now. And it's fascinating to me how he's finding these new ways of viewing the town and photographing the town and making it feel genuinely different. That shot of Amick and Getty on the street embracing each other almost plays like it's coming out of a different show entirely, or plays like it's coming out of this particular show but not the original series, even though it's set in one of the most familiar locations. And then yeah, you have her just suddenly turning totally schoolgirl giddy at this guy who she clearly has no knowledge of, and how exactly that's going to play out, I'm curious. It won't play out well, I presume, but that's a nice little thing that's been thrown on top, because it was alluded to, of course, in at the end of the second hour when he sort of gives her the, you know, the pistol salute. What do you call it? The gun finger?
I just think of it as a sound effect, more like a eep-eep.
I was going to say pew, but that and the wink. And you're sort of not sure what the connection is, but it's clear that, you know, it's very clear that something is going on. And yeah, no, that was a really just kind of an incomprehensible moment in a lot of ways on these huge and small scales all in one sequence. I was greatly impressed by that.
Also, I mean, I think this episode can really be split into two halves. I mean, once we get, again, it's another episode where Dougie doesn't enter until the second half, really. And what did you think of the Vegas section, at least in comparison to the Twin Peaks Buckhorn section?
I thought it aligned well enough. I mean, I think that with this particular show, it's kind of par for the course that we'll move from one strand to another and not totally feel at sea, even if we've spent a lot of time with both sections in question, whatever they might be. But I had been hoping to see more of Dougie, because Dougie is my favorite part of the series, probably. So I was just glad to be back there. And then I think that, yeah, as soon as we get Bushnell Mullins over his desk calling Dougie in, I thought, ah, yes, here we go. And then I also, albeit briefly, got my double serving of Sizemore for the
hell
day.
Hell yeah.
Because he is, of course, in Strange Days wearing a terrible wig. And he shows up here very briefly. So that was, you know, it was a Sizemore Sunday, which I was really pleasantly surprised by.
There's something, too, I find funny about how much of Sizemore's screen time in this is just him quietly stewing.
Mm. Yeah. Well, he's good at it.
I know.
I mean, he's probably had a lot of life experience stewing, but, you know.
We talked about that last week.
we'll bring it up anytime Tom Sizemore is mentioned. Wonderful actor, at least when he's given a good role, just, you know.
Well, I mean, he's given a good role 12 times a year.
Yeah, his IMDb page is just kind of a nightmare. But where were we? Yes, so there's all that. You know, it's kind of the standard stuff, him being lured by the coffee and then him having the vision of the one-armed man sort of leading him along, which is one aspect that I think I'm ambivalent on insofar as it really plays as just a deus ex machina, how he's kind of left drifting for the sort of the overwhelming majority of the series, and then suddenly he can just kind of be guided along by the one-armed man. I'm not sure what the logic is there exactly.
You know, because as alluded in the breakfast scene, the 2:23 p.m. breakfast scene, I should say, that they're kind of tampering with other people's dreams. I mean, as established throughout the mythology of the show and the film, but we can assume that he was somehow involved. The Lodge was somehow involved in one of the Mitchum brothers' dreams, placing the cherry pie. So they're mm-hmm. pulling the strings, really.
Sure. I guess the question of his agency is it's very uncertain, and I'm just, you know, trying to figure out how it may align, or if it doesn't, for that matter.
I brought up the Mitchum brothers. So if we want to talk about Jim Belushi and Robert Knepper this week, I will say, you said you had your double serving of Sizemore. I just this past week watched Wild Palms for the first time. Do you know what that is?
I certainly do. I've never seen it, but I certainly know what it is.
For listeners at home, this is the 1993 miniseries written by Bruce Wagner, executive produced by Oliver Stone, which is kind of a attempt to do a Pynchon meets William Gibson meets David Lynch-esque sci-fi parable. It's set in 2007 and essentially about a VR company trying to take control of America, as well as Scientologists. And it features in the leading role Jim Belushi. And it was interesting watching that, where, to be honest, Belushi is not very good in it compared to this, where he's wonderful. And something to note about Wild Palms is that apparently Belushi was pretty baffled making it. There's a trivia bit, at least IMDb, that he read the script multiple times and still had no idea what the hell was going on, and just kind of showed up to set every day and tried his best, read his lines, and I think that kind of shows in his performance in it. Yet in this, I mean, I think if people know about apparently the secrecy that went into the making of The Return, that I think actors would only get their scenes the day of.
Yes, that's what I've heard. And they would only have their material, yeah, specifically.
So essentially, I mean, Belushi was not given an advantage in this case either, yet he has a directorial vision behind him actually helping him out. So there's that.
Yeah, I guess part of it too is just how, I mean, one thing I find interesting about it is that there is not really a genuine menace to it. I mean, I you know, you don't think for a second that Cooper is actually going to be killed, you know, hour 11 into this 18-hour thing. So I think for me it's just a matter of inevitability and kind of seeing the inevitability that he will get out of this somehow, and seeing the pieces stack up as they do is, I mean, watching it stack up to kind of this inevitable end where he is going to get out of it was fun, especially because, again, it's even if I have my problems with it, the deus ex machina aspect of it, where it really is, I don't know. Yeah, just the thing of, I had a dream last night, and there was this, and there was this. And even a thing where you sort of think there's going to be a bit of Lynchian body horror as he starts to what seems to be tear away his brother Stitch is undercut, because it turns out that it's fine. Something has happened that has allowed his wound to heal in approximately, what, 24 hours at most? Yeah. No, it's great stuff.
I feel like the show is kind of almost saving its darkest stuff for the end, because obviously, if you want to look at it as a structure of Dougie, kind of Dougie was just kind of a bumbling fool throughout most of the first few episodes. Now things have been going very well for him, I feel like, just between the sex scene and this. So I feel like we're now kind of prepared for, we laugh at this character, but I think we're going to almost see the, I can't quite say the serious Dougie, but... It'll be interesting seeing that character, I think, placed within a darker circumstance.
Sure. I do wonder, I keep wondering if there will be some sort of Big Bang moment where something is just said by happenstance by somebody, and that causes him to kind of have this, you know, let's say this cosmic brain moment, perhaps. He goes from inactive brain to cosmic brain to use the popular meme format. Again, who the hell knows, but even something like cherry pie doesn't seem to set off much in him, does it? He enjoys it, certainly, but the coffee and the cherry pie are kind of... I don't know. One thing about that, and maybe you could confirm, deny, whatever, it got me thinking about how the... certain ways that this is definitely playing as an anti-nostalgia TV series. And I think it's particularly interesting how the two of the biggest signifiers of the original series, which are Coffee and Cherry Pie, are kind of coming back by accident. Or if they're happening, it's much more of a gag, and it's much more of a play on the nostalgia for it than anything else. I don't know. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that. But this episode got me thinking about that in a strong way.
I mean, I do feel like Belushi, upon seeing the cherry pie, like, cherry pie is kind of one of the most gif-able moments of the series so far. So it almost does feel like them maybe playing into nostalgia slightly.
Well, just slightly, but the fact that it's not really... It's not even his own agency that's bringing it back, is the thing. It's not as if he's just saying, oh, I could sure go for that. It's all kind of happening by accident. And he almost doesn't even seem to, not that he doesn't understand it, but his desires for it are so primal and kind of so intellectually devoid that I find it interesting. It's been sort of rattling around my brain. And I think this episode in particular, with two visual gags involving coffee and cherry pie, it came to mind.
I think what will make him wake up is finally seeing the plaid shirt he wore throughout the back half of season two.
Jesus. Wow. What if, actually, what if? One thing I want to bring up, were you also disoriented by the shooting cutting rhythm of the opening scene of this episode? How it's these three kids playing catch, but the ball will go up and it will land in one mitt, and then it'll go up, it'll be the sudden kind of jump cut, and then when the ball comes back down on the other side, it's a different kid catching it. I thought, yeah, that was something as I was watching, and I couldn't quite figure out if this was actually happening or if I was projecting something onto it. It was genuinely disorienting, and it kind of goes hand in hand with the whole thing of how if you look closely at certain tail ends of sequences in the show, you can actually see people apparently move backwards, which is something that has come up. There have been these little moments in the series so far where characters will suddenly start operating in reverse. And that kind of, I don't know, that combined with the portal, combined with the suits man, the woodsman, taking Matthew Lillard and tearing the top of his head off, kind of the sense that reality is very actively coming apart, maybe further underlined by the screaming woman. I don't know.
Maybe David Lynch just hates baseball.
Or
sports in general.
I don't know. What are examples of sports in Lynch's cinema? I guess Laura Dern's boyfriend in Blue Velvet plays football, right?
What about the kind of like hologram fighting thing in Dune?
Yeah, sure. Sure. I guess that counts.
He has a track on his first album called Football Game.
Oh, yes. It's a very good song.
Outro music, maybe.
The last scene. So, something about that I found very funny is how the dirty old woman, sort of the hobo-looking woman from the casino, shows up again and thanks Mr. Jackpots and says, I've thought about you every day. But in this, what has passed? 72 hours, maybe? that was a little gag that I found very amusing, kind of this dislocation of time as to where exactly we are, especially as time, I think, is going to start playing a more important role in the coming episodes as we get closer and closer to the day when, as dictated by Major Briggs, potentially decades ago, the sheriff's department has to go into the woods. I don't know. Something about that, realizing just how little time has passed on this show, is to me very, on the one hand, very amusing, but also curious in how I think it underlines the sense that in this series, so much is happening at once. And yeah. it's that maybe that speaks to the idea of it being catastrophic, is that the world is kind of folding in on itself at this time. Cooper has come back. There are these portals in the sky. The woman shows up headless with Major Briggs' body there. Dr. Jacoby is selling his shovels.
Well, concluding thoughts?
Concluding thoughts, I deeply love the little moment when Laura Dern just happens to be looking at the woodsman's ghost, spirit, apparition, what have you, approaching the car, and she just kind of stares at it, not quite sure what to make of it. Or maybe sure what to make of it, and I just don't know what to make of it, because there's a question of how and where her allegiances lie. And that was a nice little moment. A good little Dern moment, I would say. So, I don't know. I feel like it was underappreciated in its own time.
My concluding thoughts are, I hope it completes the projectile vomiting scene trifecta.
All right. We may very well see that.
Tune in next week for another episode with a guest, maybe.
Of some sort.
Hopefully. See you next week.